Welcome to the SEI podcast series, a production of the Carnegie Mellon University Software Engineering Institute. The SEI is a federally funded research and development center headquartered at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. A transcript of today's podcast is posted on the SEI website at sei.cmu.edu/podcasts. My name is Suzanne Miller, and today I'm pleased to introduce you to myself and Marianne Lapham. Welcome to our ongoing series, Exploring Agile Principles and Their Application Across the Department of Defense. In today's installment, we explore the 11th Agile Principle. The best architectures, requirements, and designs emerge from self-organizing teams. But first, a little bit about myself and Marianne. Marianne's work focuses on supporting and improving the acquisition of software-intensive systems. For Department of Defense programs, this means assisting and advising on software issues at the system or segment level. In addition, she leads research into software topics that are germane to acquisition of software-intensive systems, including the SEI's research in adoption of agile and lean methods in regulated settings like the DoD. My research focuses on synthesizing effective technology transition and management practices from research and industry into effective techniques for use of agile and lean methods in regulated settings. This is our 11th podcast exploring the real-world application of agile principles in Department of Defense settings. If you like what you hear today, there are already 10 podcasts in this series, and we will eventually have 12, one for each agile principle behind the Agile Manifesto. As a reminder, the four values and 12 principles of the Agile Manifesto can be found at www.agilemanifesto.org. Today, Marianne, let's talk about architecture, requirements, designs, and self-organizing teams.
When you hear the principle, best architectures and requirements and designs emerge from self-organizing teams, any self-respecting DoD manager would run screaming from the room. What do you mean emerge from a self-organizing team? Oh my gosh. You have to understand what those terms mean. That's the key to understanding what this means. It doesn't mean chaos and people are just said, go do something. Heavens no. Self-organizing means you give the team boundaries.
Boundaries, right.
And say, okay, here's the problem. You give them an initial skeleton, if you will, of an architecture. You just don't right. go make one up. It's stuff that people would call maybe sprint zero, depending on who you talk to. Mm-hmm. And then you let them go solve the problem.
Let's talk a little bit about the architecture thing, because that in the larger Agile community has been a topic of debate for some years, although I think we're seeing some resolution of that, where most Agile teams in commercial settings are starting to acknowledge the role of architecture, not just emergent architecture, but actual some design up front. They call it just enough design up front as opposed to big design up front. And we're seeing frameworks like the SAFe, the Scaled Agile Framework is one, that explicitly talk about things like architecture stories and architecture runways and doing things in a way that allow you to evolve the architecture at the same time that you're implementing the functionality.
Yeah, and SAFe requires that you have enough architecture available to keep ahead of your team.
Right. So sort of platform-centric.
I know I need to have, in advance figured out what platforms I'm going to be. If there's some infrastructure that has to be built, those usually are the architecture stories that you were mm-hmm. talking about. And there's a team, maybe one or two scrum teams, could be just one, that puts together this infrastructure framework that other people can use. That might be the first delivery. Now, they'll have potentially shippable code at the end of their sprints, but
for the end user.
Not for the end user. It's deliverable to whom?
Testers.
It's deliverable to the other developers and testers and people that are building the system.
And other stakeholders, like information assurance folks.
Right. So that's the first delivery, and it's to users, but not the end users.
And we've seen that. We've seen cases in the Air Force where they basically, the first couple of releases are actually releases to the development team and internal stakeholders, where they're essentially providing the platform. So they are actually working on that architecture. And these are cases where they're living inside of an embedded system. They're living inside a larger systems engineering framework. So they have to be able to deliver
to that part of the team,
and
that is their customer in
that
sense.
And that is their customer, and because they're living inside of a bigger entity, if you will, they have to take their cues for what their architecture is going to look like from that entity. So they don't do it in a vacuum, per se. They actually look at the system they're going to be working, living within, use that as guidelines. And they also have to use the guidelines. One of the programs we know of, they bring in their security people very early, and they build in, bake in, basically, all the things they need for the controls to work in their environment, the applicable security controls. Mm-hmm. And that becomes part of the infrastructure, and that becomes part of the boundaries that the team has to work within.
Right.
And so, yes, they have self-organizing teams, because you give the group a problem, go solve it, but you've given them the boundaries in which they have to play in, and you've given them some tools to go with it. You just don't say, here's a blank sheet of paper, go do it.
And I think that's the thing that in the Agile community at the beginning, it was that blank sheet of paper. And let's be honest, when you look at the history, many of the systems that Agile methods were tried on, especially early methods like extreme programming, were on legacy systems where you already had an architecture and the functionality was being revised, you were adding functionality,
right.
You really had an infrastructure to begin with. And in that case, you may not need as much emphasis on a pre-designed architecture.
Or the programs they were doing, the early stuff was really small. You know, Agile
came out of small
developments, and now people are expanding it because the idea is they figured out how to, you know, and it's not just SAFe, there's others out there. Scott Amberler has one, DSDM, which is a form of Agile, the most popular in Europe, has one. I think Craig Larman has one. So there's several out there. You need to go look at those if that's where you're headed.
Now, the self-organizing part of this is the other part that as you said at the beginning, sends the program managers running screaming from the room.
I have no control. Who's going to make sure they're doing the right thing at the right time? Not telling them how to do their job, but keeping some kind of order and movement in the right direction.
But this is really where the learning part happens. I mean, this is the crux of the learning. When I'm on a self-organizing team, and when we, you know, within the boundaries that I've been given, I have a lot of space in which to try out different things. I have a lot of space in which to work with other people cross-functionally to get better solutions. So this isn't just about the architecture. This is also about dealing with the requirements, understanding the requirements, dealing with the design elements that are specific to this functionality, and using all the resources across the team to make sure we get the best solution. And that's a real big win for places like the DoD that tend to be stovepiped when left sort of to their own devices, where these teams are not just the developers. It's the developers, the testers, the user interface people, the IA people, and getting those people to work together in a self-organized manner is a challenge, but it's also one of the great benefits that we've seen.
Well, it is, and one of the things you hear a lot about is developers do their stuff, and in the analysis, people can create the requirements, developers develop them, and then the testers get in and go, I can't test that. That's not a testable requirement. If they're involved up front, mm-hmm. which is what
they're all working together.
They're all working together. Not only will you get good requirements that the developers understand, but you get requirements that can be tested.
You get acceptance criteria.
Right, you get acceptance criteria for each one.
Example.
So you're killing a lot of the issues you see in more mm-hmm. big front upfront design and, you know,
yeah,
the
big
design bang.
Up front.
Big design. I can never say that right. Yeah, but the more traditional systems, you're eliminating some of the issues you see in those, and you reap benefits because you don't have those issues further down the road where it's more costly to fix them.
Now, I will also say we have seen some teams that have had problems because they didn't have that cross-functional thing happening within the team.
That's true. They have many waterfalls.
At least one case where, you know, information assurance people did not want to be involved. They saw it as a loss of independence, and they were not really appreciative of the fact that you're building architectures early. They wanted to see traditional documentation. And so that is something that can happen when you're dealing with these kinds of issues. You've got to look beyond the team to what's your environment,
right,
and make sure that you get those folks enlisted, or you figure out how you're going to deal with them so that you actually meet your obligations to them, because if you don't,
right,
then you're going to have a whole different set of issues.
Yeah, and the other group that falls in that same category is the operational test folks, because they are, by regulation, supposed to be independent. So how do you get them to play in this space is another issue you need to start figuring out up front.
Right.
Otherwise,
And we've seen more with the developmental test people, the DT&O people, we've seen those folks be directly involved in the teams.
Right, but
it's less common for the ops. For the operational test.
I know some of the groups are looking at it. It's a different way of doing business, not only from the way they traditionally want independence, but it's the way they staff their teams.
Right, right.
So there's those issues, too, that if you decide to go this agile route, it sounds really cool. Well, there's a lot of issues you have to overcome, and you have to think about it. And contrary to popular belief, you have to plan.
Yeah. Now, our colleagues, Ipek Oskaya,
yes,
and Rod Nord, who are working directly in agile and architecting, they'd beat us silly if we didn't say something about technical debt here.
Oh, you're right.
So the concept of technical debt is that as you accumulate implementations, you sometimes, either through defects or through conscious decisions, say, I'm not going to deal with this right now. And so you accumulate these areas where you have to later go back and fix stuff. And in the agile world, they would call that refactoring. But there's a cost to that. You can't just be moving forward. If you've got technical debt that's accumulated, you can't just move forward and ignore it. At some point, it's going to come back and bite you. And so that's the other piece about the self-organizing teams, is that the teams need to have enough power to understand what they're doing and when they're pushing things forward. But there also needs to be some governance that helps them to understand when they've exceeded the boundaries of the technical debt that's acceptable, and when they need to get help from the external part of the organization, the systems engineering or other parts of the organization, to make sure that the architecture can evolve. So that's the flip side to this.
That is the flip side, and sometimes the governance or the ideas of what's the boundaries of when technical debt is too much, that comes from the technical team, not necessarily from the externals,
right,
because those guys really know when things are to the point where if I make one more change, something's going to break.
Yeah.
Because they've postponed things.
Well, your continuous integration cycle.
Yeah,
often
and the we'll show
right.
you that, and so you need to allow that. You know, you just can't say, oh no, we'll do that later.
Yeah.
You have to allow that at a certain point. You have to be prepared to include that in your one of your sprints. Otherwise, you are going
and
to be shooting yourself in the
foot. And there are techniques for doing that. And there
yes.
are people that have that program in. You know, what sometimes they're called hardening sprints, and other activities within a release so that you don't let that go too long.
Or some people allow a percentage in a later release, you know,
mm-hmm.
not the first one, because you're not going to have any the first time, but in the third or fourth release, you might allow 10-15%, whatever, for these technical debt issues. And if there's not severe enough to fix, then you don't. But you allow that so that you've
right.
already got a plan that, yes, we're going to at least consider it. So,
okay. I think that about covers it on this particular topic, although there's always more to say on these things.
Oh, there is, but I think we did good.
And I want to thank you for this conversation today. In
You're
the
very
next
welcome.
Episode in the series, we're going to explore the final Agile principle. At regular intervals, the team reflects on how to become more effective, then tunes and adjusts its behavior accordingly. Listings for papers, blog posts, and podcasts related to SEI research on Agile adoption in DoD can be found at sei.cmu.edu/acquisition/research. If you'd like more information about the SEI's recent publications in all areas of our work, you can download all of our technical reports and notes at sei.cmu.edu/library/reportspapers.cfm. This podcast is available on the SEI website at sei.cmu.edu/podcasts and on Carnegie Mellon University's iTunes U site. As always, if you have any questions, please don't hesitate to email us at info@sei.cmu.edu. Thank you for listening.